you can still fast. You don't eat wheat, you can still fast. You have a nut allergy, you can still fast. You don't have time, you can still fast. You don't have money, you can still fast. You are traveling all the time, you can still fast. You don't cook, you can still fast. You are 80 years old, you can still fast. You have problems chewing, you can still fast. What could possibly be simpler? Elizabeth, Fasting Success Story. I grew up in South Africa and was overweight most of my life, with periods of weight loss due to yo-yo dieting. In 2002, I went on a fat-free, high-carbohydrate diet for 2 years. Early in 2004, I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, high cholesterol, and high blood pressure, and started on medication. My father and siblings were also on medication for these concerns. At 105 kilograms, 231 pounds, I switched from my fat-free, high-carbohydrate diet to a low-carbohydrate, severely calorie-restricted diet. My weight went down to 75 kilograms, 165 pounds, over about 18 months. But the diet was so restrictive, it was not sustainable. Inevitably, my weight climbed back up. At the end of 2010, I was horrified when an ultrasound showed that I had non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. In April 2011, my doctor added insulin injections to my type 2 diabetes medications. He said I had to increase the insulin dose until my blood glucose level was down, with no other explanation. So I did just that. Late in 2011, I was injecting 120 units of long-acting insulin every night and 80 units of rapid-acting insulin with each meal. I was also still taking my other diabetes medications morning and night. After I started taking insulin, no matter what I did or how hard I exercised, I could not lose weight, even when I quit carbohydrates. I knew it had something to do with the insulin. Fast forward to January 2015, I had had enough. I began cutting carbohydrates again and started a 30-minute high-intensity interval training class. My glucose levels were dropping to about 2.3 millimolar per liter. Then I came across an article by Dr. Fung, who had just presented at the low-carb, high-fat convention in Cape Town, saying type 2 diabetes could be reversed. I watched his YouTube presentations, and for the first time, I found something that made sense. I immediately decided that quitting insulin was my first priority, but I could not find a single dietitian or doctor in South Africa who would help me. In January 2015, my weight was 96 kilograms, 212 pounds, fasting glucose 9.5 millimolar per liter, HbA1c 7.6%, insulin dosage 360 units a day. So I read more on Dr. Fung's intensive dietary management blog, and toward the end of February, I started a fasting regimen along with low-carbohydrate meals. I cut all my insulin doses in half. I began with 3 days of fasting a week. On fasting days, I drank coffee with cream in the morning and water with a slice of lemon in it the remainder of the day. Later, I learned that you don't really need breakfast. So I started eating just one meal in the late afternoon on non-fasting days. My glucose levels continued to drop, so I quit all injected insulin and continued to eat a low-carb paleo-style diet. In other words, real food. My weight was slowly coming down and the needle on the scale was 87.8 kilograms, 194 pounds. I had lost a total of 6.2 kilograms, 14 pounds of body fat, 2.9% of my total, and my waistline dropped 35 centimeters, 14 inches. In June of 2015, weight was 79.7 kilograms, 176 pounds, fasting glucose 7.6 millimolars per liter, HbA1c 6.2, and insulin dosage none. By the beginning of June, my weight was 79.7 kilograms, 176 pounds, and I had lost a total of 13.03 kilograms, 29 pounds of body fat, 7.3%, and a total of 46.5 centimeters, 18 inches from my waist. I continued my fasting regimen, and in August, I finally found a physician to help me the last bit of the way. My results have astounded various people in various ways, including some friends in the medical profession who were too polite to tell me that they thought I was nuts. November 2015, weight 68 kilograms, 150 pounds, fasting glucose 5.9 millimolar per liter, HbA1c 5.3, insulin dosage none. It's the end of November 2015, and I now weigh 68 kilograms, 150 pounds, and have lost a total of 20.64 kilograms, 46 pounds of body fat, 12.4%, and a total of 77.5 centimeters, 31 inches from my waist. I realize that I am always going to struggle with my love of carbohydrates, especially bread and fruit, but I know that my way of eating real foods combined with a fasting regimen is sustainable. As Dr. Fung put it, there are times of feast, but it is easy enough to balance these with times of famine, fasting. I feel so much better having lost so much weight, and I have lots of energy when fasting. Chapter 5. Fasting for Weight Loss. Long-term dieting is an exercise in futility. All diets, whether the Mediterranean diet, the Atkins diet, or even the old-fashioned low-fat, low-calorie diet, seem to produce weight loss in the short term. But after some initial success, weight loss plateaus and the dreaded weight regain follows. Even low-carbohydrate diets, which are proven to result in more weight loss than any other diets in the short term, show the same inexorable plateau and weight regain. This relentless regain occurs despite continued dietary compliance and regardless of dietary strategy. In other words, eventually, all diets fail. The question is, why? Eat less, move more doesn't work. Have you ever heard the phrase, the proof is in the pudding? The original version was actually, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. It means that to really judge whether something is successful or not, you must look at the end results. Just because you think something will work does not necessarily mean it will. So let's apply this to obesity. The dominant nutritional paradigm of the last half century has been calories in, calories out. The idea is that consuming fewer calories than are used will ultimately lead to lasting weight loss. Dietary fat being calorically dense, there are 9 calories in every gram of fat, compared to 4 in every gram of carbohydrate or protein, was believed to be especially fattening. The commonly recommended weight loss approach of a low-fat, low-calorie diet combined with increased exercise, all aimed at increasing the number of calories burned while reducing the number of calories consumed, can be neatly summarized as eat less, move more. There is certainly a logic at work here, and we can imagine all kinds of reasons why it should work. But does it? What are the results of this approach? As you and I both know, this dietary approach has been widely advocated over the past few decades and has created a huge, rampant global obesity epidemic. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta closely tracks obesity trends in the United States, and according to its data, in 2015, no state had an obesity rate below 20%. Only 20 years earlier, in 1995, no state had an obesity rate above 20%. So we have two incontrovertible facts. Fact number one, over the past 20 years, conventional weight loss advice has called for eating less and moving more. Fact number two, over the past 20 years, obesity rates have exploded. Considering these facts together, there are only two possible conclusions. The first is that our standard dietary advice is good, but people are simply not following it. This would be a real stretch of the imagination. When it comes to health, people really do listen to their doctors, as we can see when we look at other lifestyle changes doctors began to recommend. When doctors advised people to stop smoking, they stopped smoking. In the mid-1960s, as the data linking lung cancer and smoking became clear, the Surgeon General of the United States first issued a public health warning. Cigarette consumption shortly thereafter began its relentless downward trend, which was accelerated by the Surgeon General's report on secondhand smoke. When doctors advised people to watch their blood pressure and cholesterol, they watched their blood pressure and cholesterol. Yet somehow, when doctors advised people to eat less and move more, they didn't? Doubtful. This way of thinking is also known as blaming the victim. We assume the advice is good, and therefore, if it fails, it must be because the person didn't really follow the advice. This shifts the blame from the advice giver to the advice taker. Americans have, in fact, followed the government's nutritional guidelines. The USDA's first Dietary Guidelines for Americans was released in 1977. It recommended that Americans adjust their diets to meet two specific goals: increase consumption of carbohydrates and reduce intake of total fat. Although caloric reduction was not a specified goal, the reduction in dietary fat was expected to reduce calories, since fat is calorically dense compared to carbohydrates. Since 1970, consumption of vegetables, fruits, and grains has increased, and consumption of red meat, eggs, and animal fats has declined, just as the USDA's dietary guidelines recommended. But the promised benefits never materialized. The second possible conclusion, the only one that remains, is that the advice to eat less and move more is simply wrong, and scientific studies back this up. We've known about the abysmal success rate of the caloric reduction approach, the one that's based on simply reducing calories consumed and increasing calories burned, for decades. A 1959 study estimated its failure rate at a sky-high 98%. Only 2% of dieters using a caloric reduction strategy were able to maintain a 20-pound weight loss for 2 years. More recently, in 2015, researchers in the United Kingdom reviewed the weight loss rates of more than 175,000 obese men and women over the previous 9 years. The probability of achieving a normal weight by caloric reduction alone was 0.8% in women and 0.47% in men. So the best case scenario using conventional calorie counting methods is a 99.2% failure rate. Even the very best study ever done on caloric reduction as a path to lasting weight loss showed that it failed. The Women's Health Initiative, a gigantic randomized controlled trial, followed almost 50,000 women over 7.5 years. One group of the women followed a low-fat, low-calorie diet, high in grains, fruits, and vegetables, and reduced their total daily calories by 361 calories. Their percentage of calories from fat was reduced from 38.8% to 29.8%. They also increased the amount of exercise by 14%. The other group followed their usual diet. The expected weight loss for the low-calorie increased exercise group was 36 pounds per year, or 252 pounds over 7 years. The other group was not expected to see any weight loss. The final results were a complete shock to everybody involved. The actual difference in weight loss between the two groups was not even 2 pounds. Worse still, the average waist size in the low-calorie increased exercise group grew from 35 to 35.4 inches. These women, who so carefully followed the eat less, move more strategy for so long, actually ended up fatter than ever. There's a better known example to be found in The Biggest Loser, a long-running reality TV show that pits obese contestants against one another in a bid to lose the most weight. While short-term results are often stunning, contestants nearly always regain weight after filming ends. Kai Hibbard, the winner of season 3, said of participating on the show, "It was the biggest mistake of my life." Season 2's Suzanne Mendonca says that there is never a reunion show because we're all fat again. But why should this happen? The Biggest Loser diet restricts calories to 70% of baseline energy requirements, which usually means 1,200 to 1,500 calories per day. This is combined with vigorous physical exertion for several hours per day, 6 days a week. This is the classic eat less, move more advice given by dietitians and healthcare professionals everywhere. No wonder the Biggest Loser diet ranked number 3 in weight loss diets, according to U.S. News & World Report in 2015. A study of Biggest Loser contestants showed that in 30 weeks of filming, average weight dropped from 329 pounds to 202 pounds. That's an average decrease of 127 pounds. Body fat dropped on average from 49% to 28%. Almost all of the weight lost was fat mass as opposed to lean tissue or fat-free mass. There is inevitably some lean tissue lost along with fat, but this is generally skin and connective tissue, not necessarily muscle. Wow. Amazing. Unfortunately, those results simply didn't last. 6 years after their almost miraculous weight loss, 13 of the 14 contestants studied had regained the weight they'd lost. This is a failure rate of 93%. The main reason for the weight regain is that the contestants' metabolisms had slowed significantly. We'll explain why later in this chapter. Danny Cahill, the winner of Season 8, lost 239 pounds during the competition. However, his body was now burning 800 calories less per day than it had previously. This proved to be an insurmountable obstacle to lasting weight loss, and sure enough, he, along with almost all the other contestants, ended up regaining all their hard-lost weight. But I probably didn't really need to convince you that eat less, move more doesn't work. You already knew that. For the vast majority of people, personal experience confirms this epic fail. Yes, studies prove that it does not work, but just as significantly, so do the bitter experiences of the millions of people who have tried it. 99% failure rate? Sounds about right to me. This is the cruel hoax of the eat less, move more strategy. It is cruel because all of our trusted health sources tell us it should work, and when it fails, we blame ourselves. Here's the thing, though. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that when followed to the letter, eat less, move more does work. In the end, it actually doesn't matter. Whether it's good advice that people don't follow or bad advice that people do follow, the result is the same. It doesn't produce weight loss. And if the end results are bad, and they are, then the advice is bad. The proof is in the pudding. What is to be done? The only logical conclusion is to change that advice. We need a new strategy. Fasting. The single compartment model of calorie storage and use. Calories in, go into the body, calories out. Why eat less, move more fails, how our bodies really use calories. The reason eat less, move more doesn't work for weight loss is that it's based on a false idea about how our bodies use calories. The single compartment model. According to this model, the body reduces all foods to simply calories and stores those calories for use in what we can think of as a single compartment. Then the body accesses that compartment to use the calories for exercise and basal metabolism. Remember, that refers to the body's basic functions, such as breathing, removing toxins from the bloodstream, digesting foods, and so on. All these require energy from calories. This model is like a bathroom sink. Calories like water can flow into or out of this sink. Excess calories are held in this sink and can be easily accessed if our bodies require more calories. For example, exercise would drain calories out of this sink. There is no distinction made between any of the storage forms of calories. Whether calories are stored as glucose, which is used for immediate energy, glycogen, which is used in the intermediate time frame, or fat, which is long-term energy storage, all calories are treated equally. However, this model is known to be a complete fabrication. It does not exist except in our imaginations. It is more accurate to use a two-compartment model because there are two distinct ways energy is stored in the body, as glycogen in the liver and as body fat. When we eat, our body derives energy from three main sources: glucose, carbohydrates, fat, and protein. Only two of these are stored for later use, glucose and fat. The body can't store protein, so excess protein that can't be used right away is converted to glucose. Glucose is stored in the liver as glycogen, but the liver's capacity for storing glycogen is limited. Once glycogen stores are full, excess calories must be stored as body fat. Dietary fat is absorbed directly into the bloodstream without passing through the liver, and what's not used is stored as body fat. This was one of the reasons why low-fat diets were initially recommended, but the immediate destination of ingested calories is not the main determinant of weight gain. Think of glycogen as a refrigerator. It's designed for short-term storage of food. It's very easy to move food in and out, but the storage space is limited. Body fat, on the other hand, is more like a basement freezer. It's designed for long-term storage and is more difficult to access, but it has much greater capacity. Plus, you can always add more freezers to the basement if you need them. When we buy groceries, we store food in the refrigerator first, and then when the fridge is full, we store the excess food in the freezer. That is, we store food energy first as glycogen, and then when the space for glycogen is full, as body fat. Both body fat and glycogen are used for energy in the absence of food, but they aren't used equally or at the same time. The body prefers to use glycogen for energy rather than body fat. This is logical because it is easier to burn glycogen in terms of our analogy. It's much easier to get food from the refrigerator in the kitchen than to trek all the way down to the freezer in the basement. And as long as there is food in the fridge, we won't retrieve any from the freezer. In other words, if you need 200 calories of energy to go for a walk, the body will get that energy from glycogen as long as it's available. It won't go to the trouble of accessing body fat. The two-compartment model of calorie storage and use. Calories in, glycogen in the refrigerator, produces an insulin response. Body fat is like a freezer, and the calories out. The two compartments, the fridge and the freezer, are not used simultaneously, but sequentially. You need to mostly empty out the fridge before you can use what's in the freezer. You need to burn most of the glycogen before you can burn fat. In essence, the body can burn either sugar or fat, but not both. Insulin's crucial role in weight loss and regain. How easy it is to get to the fat freezer depends upon the hormone insulin. Is the freezer locked away in the basement behind steel gates, or is it located right beside the refrigerator? Insulin levels are the prime determinant. When we are not eating, insulin levels are low, allowing full access to the fat freezer. The body is able to easily get at the stored fat. With low insulin levels, you don't even have to completely empty the glycogen refrigerator before opening the fat freezer, since it's so easily accessible. Think about your fridge at home. Does it have to be completely empty of everything, including that half-empty bottle of ketchup and tub of yogurt, before you open that pack of burgers from the freezer? Of course not. Similarly, with low insulin levels, the body can burn fat even if there is still some glucose around. That means that if you're cutting calories and have low insulin levels, it's easy for your body to compensate for the reduced food energy by getting some fat out of the freezer, even if your glycogen fridge isn't completely empty. But the emptier your glycogen fridge, the more likely you will be to use what's in the fat freezer, and the easier it is to get to the freezer, the more likely it is that you will use it. Fasting All-Stars, Dr. Bert Herring. After a week or two of fasting for 19 hours a day and eating only within a 5-hour window, I was surprised to see that my excess weight had clearly started to melt away. I had only 20 extra pounds at that time, but the weight bothered me because my efforts to eat less and exercise more had failed to eliminate it. In the years that followed, I kept turning to this eating schedule to lose weight that inevitably accumulated whenever I would drift back to eating 3 meals a day. I found that the wide interval eating schedule worked every time. Not only do low insulin levels allow access to the fat freezer, they actually trigger fat burning for energy. If insulin levels are abnormally low, then fat is continually burned. We see this situation in type 1 diabetes, when the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas are destroyed. As insulin falls to undetectable levels, patients, often children, burn through all their fat stores, and are unable to gain weight no matter how many calories they consume. Untreated, this is a fatal disease. Treatment with insulin injections allows them to store fat normally once again. On the other hand, high insulin levels prevent the body from accessing the fat in the freezer. It is locked away behind steel bars. Insulin inhibits lipolysis. It stops the body from burning fat. High insulin levels, which are normal after meals, signal our body to store some of the incoming energy. Logically, therefore, we also stop burning stored fat. Why bother when there's energy from food? This doesn't just happen after meals, however. We also see this in diseases of too much insulin. For example, insulin injections often used in the treatment of diabetes commonly lead to increased fat accumulation because the body is unable to burn fat. That's great for type 1 diabetics who have too little fat to begin with, but not so great for type 2 diabetics who usually have too much. Insulin resistance, sometimes called prediabetes or metabolic syndrome, is the most common situation where insulin levels are persistently kept abnormally high. Insulin resistance. One of insulin's main jobs is to move glucose from the bloodstream into the cells so that it can be used for energy. If you have insulin resistance, your cells are no longer sensitive to insulin. Normal amounts of insulin are not able to move glucose into cells, leading to a buildup of glucose in the blood. To compensate, the body must produce extra insulin to force the glucose in. This leads to constant high insulin levels, which blocks fat burning. We'll cover this in more detail in the next chapter on type 2 diabetes and fasting. But what causes insulin resistance in the first place? The clue lies in its very name. Insulin resistance develops because cells need to resist the effects of too much insulin. The root cause of the problem is consistently high levels of insulin, which creates a vicious cycle. Too much insulin creates resistance. Insulin resistance triggers high levels of insulin, and that in turn only serves to stimulate more resistance. The cycle reinforces itself each time it goes around. The way to successfully break the insulin resistance cycle is not to continually increase insulin levels, but to drastically decrease insulin levels. This sounds almost counterintuitive, but consider the analogous problem of antibiotic resistance. When an antibiotic is first used, it kills off most bacteria, but a few bacteria are naturally resistant, and these survive. And with the rest of the bacteria gone, they're able to flourish without any competition for resources. These resistant bacteria reproduce and spread, rendering the antibiotic less effective in general. There are fewer bacteria that it will work against. In this case, antibiotics create antibiotic resistance. How do you stop antibiotic resistance? The knee-jerk reaction is to use even higher doses of antibiotics to kill the resistant bacteria. And this will work for a time, but eventually, the higher dose of antibiotics only creates more resistance. This creates a vicious cycle of antibiotic usage and development of resistance. The answer is the exact opposite. We must severely curtail the use of antibiotics so resistant bacteria don't flourish. The same logic applies to insulin resistance. When our cells become less sensitive to insulin, the body's knee-jerk reaction is to increase insulin production. It helps for a while, but over time, this only creates more insulin resistance and triggers the vicious cycle of increasing insulin and increasing resistance. The answer is really the exact opposite. Since insulin resistance develops in response to persistently high insulin levels, we must create recurrent periods of very low insulin levels. If we are unable to break the cycle of insulin resistance, then insulin levels remain high. This blocks our ability to burn the body fat we have so carefully stored away. Our body is constantly receiving the signal to store energy as fat and is never told to burn fat. Insulin plays a crucial role in the decision of which fuel to burn. High insulin plus reduced calories equals slowing metabolism. To find out what all this has to do with losing weight, let's return to the single compartment and two compartment models. Remember that the traditional advice to eat less, move more for weight loss is based on the single compartment model, the incorrect idea that all calories are equal and stored in one single compartment. So if you're using more calories than you're consuming, you must be burning body fat. In reality, the body stores energy as both glycogen and body fat. That's the two-compartment model. To burn fat, two things must happen. You must burn through most of your stored glycogen, and insulin levels must drop low enough to release the fat stores. And neither task is easy. When stored glycogen gets low, your body senses it and starts to get antsy. It triggers hunger signals, so you want to eat more. If you don't eat enough to fill up the glycogen stores, but your insulin remains high, body fat can't be released. The body's only remaining option is to decrease your metabolism so that you're burning less energy. When either food or glycogen is available, we do not use our less accessible fat stores. This ensures that body fat is only used in times of need. But over decades of abundant glucose, fat stores proliferate because we never allow our fridge to empty. In other words, the food goes into the freezer, but it never gets a chance to come back out. And as insulin resistance progresses, the resulting high insulin levels make it harder and harder to access the fat stores. The body always wants to stay at a certain weight, and any deviation above or below that weight triggers adaptive mechanisms to get us to return to that weight. That's why, after weight loss, we become hungrier and our metabolism relentlessly slows so that we have to eat even less just to maintain our lower weight. That's the body trying to get us to gain weight to get us back to our set weight. The reason the body has to resort to decreasing metabolism and increasing hunger is because insulin remains high, so it doesn't have access to the energy stored as fat. Your body has no other option but to slow metabolism. It's trying to conserve energy because it can't get at the fat freezer. This is why insulin resistance plays such a crucial role in obesity. The high insulin levels tell your body to hang on to body fat and simultaneously trigger the body to lower your metabolism. This inexorably erodes weight loss efforts. Body fat plateaus and then ruthlessly climbs back up, even as the proper diet is maintained. For some of us, changing what we eat is clearly not enough. Let's take an example. Suppose you eat 2,000 calories per day. Your weight is stable, so you are burning 2,000 calories per day. There are 3,500 calories in a pound of fat. So if you carry 100 pounds of fat, there are 350,000 calories in fat stores. Now let's say you want to lose weight, so you reduced your daily calories to 1,200. Initially, fat will be lost to make up for the reduced calories. However, if you have insulin resistance, then persistently high insulin levels will make it difficult to access fat stores. The high insulin is instructing the body to store energy, not burn it. The body is used to burning 2,000 calories, but now only 1,200 are available, so it is forced to reduce its energy expenditure to match. Basal metabolic rate decreases to 1,200 calories. The major problem, as you can see, is not that there aren't enough calories available. There are 350,000 calories stored away in the fat freezer. The problem is that these calories are not available for the body to use. The main issue is how to get access to the energy locked away in the fat. Insulin is the crucial factor to consider here, not the number of calories you eat. This explains why the Biggest Loser contestants, just like all dieters using the eat less, move more approach, gained their weight back. Their metabolism slowed down in response to caloric reduction. The heavy exercise schedule demanded by the show is also not sustainable for long. Between the slowed metabolism and the reduction in exercise, we see the very familiar weight plateau. Once calorie expenditure drops below intake, we see the even more familiar weight regain. Bam! Goodbye, reunion show. Imagine how this would feel. Reducing your caloric intake by 800 calories per day, as the contestants did, means that you feel cold, lethargic, and tired as your body starts to slow down to conserve energy. After a while, you can't take it anymore. As you increase your calories slightly, you are still eating less than you used to, but because of the slowed metabolism, now you are gaining weight. You return to your original weight as your friends and family silently accuse you of cheating on your diet. All of this is completely predictable. Since the caloric reduction strategy has a known 99% failure rate, it's no surprise that the Biggest Loser strategy has a similarly dismal outlook. The solution: fasting. When we eat, insulin rises and blocks fat burning, and the body instead burns glucose, which is now freely available from the ingested food. But of the three macronutrients, carbohydrates, fat, and protein, carbohydrates stimulate the production of insulin the most. Refined carbs and sugar, in particular, have the greatest effect on insulin, so a diet low in these is most certainly a great start for breaking the insulin resistance cycle and losing weight. Yet for some people, this is not enough. Since all foods raise insulin levels, the best answer is to completely abstain from food. The answer we are looking for is, in a word, fasting. Fasting versus low-carb diets. Both low-carb diets and fasting are able to reduce insulin. So why can't a successful weight loss strategy be simply eliminating all carbohydrates instead of fasting? It's simply a question of power. Reducing refined carbohydrates reduces insulin. However, protein, especially from animal sources, also raises insulin. Fasting by restricting everything keeps insulin lower. Fasting is simply more powerful. Very low carbohydrate diets, in which carbs compose less than 3% of total calories, are very effective at reducing blood sugar in those with type 2 diabetes compared to a standard diet, in which carbs compose 55% of total calories. This holds true even when the number of calories consumed are identical. In other words, the glucose-lowering benefits of carb restriction are not simply due to calorie restriction. This is useful knowledge, especially considering how many health professionals insist it's all about the calories. The very low-carb diet does remarkably well, providing you 71% of the benefits of fasting without actually fasting. But sometimes low-carb just isn't enough. I've had many patients who limited their carbohydrates but still had elevated blood sugars. How do you get more power? Fasting. Insulin is the main driver of obesity and diabetes. A very low-carb diet can reduce insulin by more than 50%, but you can go another 50% by fasting. That's power. Fasting is simply the most efficient and effective way to lower insulin levels. Notice, however, I did not say it was the easiest. But do you want a method that is easy or a method that works? Fasting stops insulin resistance when caloric reduction doesn't. There are those that argue that fasting is beneficial only to the extent that it reduces calories. But if that's the case, why is there such a striking difference between caloric reduction and fasting? Caloric reduction strategies like eat less, move more fail virtually every single time, yet fasting is often effective when simple caloric reduction is not. Why? The short answer is that when you're eating regularly, even if you're eating fewer calories, you're not getting the beneficial hormonal changes of fasting. During fasting, unlike during caloric reduction, metabolism stabilizes or even goes up to maintain normal energy levels. Adrenaline and growth hormone increase to maintain energy and muscle mass. Blood sugar and insulin levels go down as the body changes from burning sugar to burning fat. All this begins to address the long-term problem of insulin resistance. A recent randomized trial illustrated the difference between the two strategies very well. The study compared the effectiveness of daily caloric reduction and intermittent fasting among 107 women. One group reduced their daily caloric intake from 2,000 calories to 1,500 calories. The other group was allowed normal caloric intake, 2,000 calories, 5 days a week, but only 25% of that, 500 calories, on the remaining 2 days. This is referred to as a 5-2 fast. This means that over the course of a week, average caloric intake for the two groups was very similar, 10,500 calories per week for the reduced calorie group and 11,000 calories per week for the fasting group. Both groups consumed similar Mediterranean-style diets with 30% fat. After 6 months, both groups had similar levels of weight loss and fat loss, but the 5-2 fasting group showed a clear, substantial improvement in insulin levels and insulin resistance, whereas the caloric reduction group did not. In the long term, this is a crucial problem with caloric reduction. Higher insulin resistance eventually leads to higher insulin levels, which in turn contribute to higher insulin resistance in a vicious cycle. These higher insulin levels inexorably lead to obesity. The inability of most diets to reduce insulin resistance is exactly why they eventually result in weight regain. Fasting, on the other hand, introduces prolonged periods of low insulin levels, which breaks the cycle of high insulin and insulin resistance. Another way to look at this is that most diets ignore the biological principles of homeostasis. The body adapts to changing environments. For example, if you are in a dark room and suddenly go into the bright sunlight, you will momentarily be blinded, but within moments your eyes will adapt. The same applies to weight loss. If you maintain a constant reduced calorie diet, the body will quickly adapt to it. Energy expenditure, metabolism, declines to match the reduced intake. Weight plateaus, then is regained. This is not because you have stopped your diet, but because your body has now adapted to it. To prevent the body from adapting to the new weight loss strategy and maintain weight loss requires an intermittent strategy, not a constant one. This is a crucial distinction. Restricting some foods all the time differs from restricting all foods some of the time. This is the difference between failure and success. Fasting All-Stars, Abel James. As a celebrity coach on ABC's My Diet is Better Than Yours, I worked with contestant Kurt Morgan, who began the competition at 352 pounds and 52% body fat. After just 14 weeks following the wild diet with intermittent fasting, Kurt lost an astounding 87 pounds. More importantly, Kurt dropped from 52% body fat to less than 30% body fat, nearly doubling the fat loss results of competing dietary approaches. In my experience, combining a high-fat, low-carb nutrition plan with intermittent fasting and strategic strength training can result in rapid and dramatic fat loss. Bariatric surgery, an argument for fasting. One intensive weight loss strategy has proved far more successful than eat less, move more. Bariatric surgery, commonly called stomach stapling. A study directly comparing Biggest Loser contestants, who you'll recall used the eat less, move more strategy, but ultimately regained the weight they lost, to bariatric patients with similar weight loss, found that while the contestants experienced metabolic slowdown, the bariatric surgery group did not. Bariatric surgery is also spectacularly successful for the reversal of type 2 diabetes. In one study, a stunning 95% of adolescent patients with type 2 diabetes who underwent bariatric surgery saw their disease reversed. In the same study, after 3 years, 74% saw their high blood pressure resolved and 66% saw their abnormal lipids resolved. Why does bariatric surgery work so well when other diets fail? There have been many theories. The first hypothesis proposed that the removal of most of the healthy stomach produced these benefits. The normal stomach secretes a number of hormones, so the theory went, removing the stomach must reduce some mystery hormone, resulting in the benefits. This is pretty far-fetched. Newer types of weight loss surgeries, such as gastric banding, involve putting a band around the stomach rather than removing parts of the stomach. This kind of surgery is just as successful at reversing type 2 diabetes and reducing insulin resistance, so the benefit cannot be due to the reduction of some mystery hormone secreted by the stomach. Another thought was that loss of fat cells explained the benefits. Fat cells, adipocytes, actively secrete many different types of hormones, such as leptin, a regulator of body weight. If the fat cells themselves play a role in sustaining obesity, then removal of fat cells would be beneficial. However, liposuction, the mechanical removal of subcutaneous fat, has no metabolic benefit. In one study, the removal of 10 kilograms, 22 pounds of subcutaneous fat did not significantly improve blood sugars. There was no metabolic improvement, only cosmetic ones. Sidebar. What happens when we burn fat? Ketones and ketoacidosis. You may have heard of a ketogenic diet. It's been quickly growing in popularity in the last several years and is known to be helpful for a wide range of health problems, including obesity. As it happens, a ketogenic diet and fasting have several features in common. A ketogenic diet gets its name from ketone bodies. These are substances the body produces during fat burning. They're what fuels the brain when glucose is scarce. A ketogenic diet helps shift the body from burning glucose to burning fat, which results in the creation of ketones. Of course, fasting causes the body to burn fat too, and that means it also results in the creation of ketones. Body fat is composed mostly of triglycerides, which are molecules made of one glycerol backbone to which three fatty acids of varying lengths are attached. During fat burning, the triglyceride molecule is broken down into the glycerol backbone and the three fatty acids. The fatty acids are used directly by most of the organs of the body, including the liver, kidney, heart, and muscles. However, certain cells are not able to burn fat, including the inner part of the kidney, renal medulla, and red blood cells. To supply the glucose those cells need, the liver uses the glycerol backbone to manufacture new glucose molecules. More importantly, though, the brain cannot use fatty acids either. Ketone bodies produced during fat burning fill that gap, and the brain becomes powered mostly on ketones, which supply up to 75% of its energy needs. This dramatically reduces the brain's need for glucose, enabling adequate glucose production from glycerol. In this way, triglycerides provide energy in the form of fatty acids, ketones, and glucose, enough for the entire body. So yes, the brain still requires glucose to function normally during fasting, but we do not need to eat glucose. We can manufacture enough glucose to power the entire body simply from body fat. This is a normal situation. This is the way our body is designed to work. If you have type 1 diabetes, you may have been warned about the dangers of diabetic ketoacidosis. This isn't the same as ketosis, which is simply the state of producing ketone bodies. In diabetic ketoacidosis, the body produces ketones even though blood sugar levels are very high. In this situation, insulin levels should be high to handle the blood sugar. But with the insulin-producing pancreatic beta cells destroyed, the body doesn't produce enough insulin. This is why type 1 diabetics need to take insulin. Their bodies simply don't make enough. Due to the lack of insulin, the body produces lots of ketones. But since there's plenty of glucose in the bloodstream and the brain prefers to use glucose, the ketones are not burned for fuel. Instead, they pile up outside cells like unused logs of firewood. This creates a dangerous, even life-threatening situation. In the normal, non-diabetic situation, ketones are high but are continuously being burned by the brain for fuel. If you don't have type 1 diabetes, don't worry, you won't develop ketoacidosis. But there is no real magic or mystery here. Bariatric surgery works because it triggers a sudden and severe caloric reduction. All of the benefits of bariatric surgery are also seen during fasting. Simply put, bariatric surgery is surgically enforced fasting. Bariatric surgery requires patients to dramatically reduce their food intake. Eating too much results in nausea and vomiting. This sudden, severe caloric reduction allows the same hormonal adaptation seen during fasting that keep the resting metabolic rate steady, so it doesn't drop as it does when weight is lost due to more gradual, continual caloric reduction. Long-term studies found no decrease in metabolism other than that expected due to the weight loss itself. Carrying 300 pounds of weight takes more energy than carrying 200 pounds, so a small slowdown is expected. When we refer to slowing metabolism, we mean the slowdown in excess of that. Adrenaline and growth hormone increase, helping to maintain lean muscle mass and keep metabolism high. Insulin and blood glucose levels fall. The eat less, move more strategy for daily caloric reduction doesn't provide these hormonal benefits. However, fasting does. Head-to-head studies reveal that fasting is actually superior to bariatric surgery in both weight loss and reduction in blood sugars. Both methods are also effective for type 2 diabetes. So here's the crucial question. if all the benefits of bariatric surgery come from the sudden and severe reduction in calories, why not just fast and skip the surgery entirely? In essence, fasting is bariatric surgery without the surgery. There is a price to be paid for any surgery, and with bariatric surgery, complications are common. Within 3 years of the surgery, 13% of adolescent patients had problems severe enough to require surgery. The most common complication involves scarring that progressively narrows the esophagus, resulting in difficulty eating. To fix this, progressively larger-sized tubes are shoved down the patient's throat to open things up. This procedure is often repeated over and over. Fasting All-Stars, Mark Sisson. Fasting weight loss can often be fleeting because a fair amount of water is lost in the early days, either through a reduction in inflammation from removing offending foods or from the release of glycogen and its stored water. The key to ratcheting down the weight is to not overeat when the fasting period has finished and to maintain a moderate exercise regimen. So why not just fast instead? I cannot think of any good reason, but the common perception is that if I, as a doctor, recommend cutting out a person's healthy stomach and rewiring their intestines, it's great and I'm serving my patient well. But if I recommend fasting, which accomplishes everything that bariatric surgery does without any complications or costs, then I'm crazy. It's a bizarre conclusion. Fasting is much safer and easier, and its results are just as good, if not better. Perhaps the most common reason people give for their reluctance to fast is that it is too difficult. Yet, too often, this assessment is made before even trying to fast. People say this to me all the time. I can't fast for 24 hours. So I ask them, how do you know? Have you tried? To which they answer, no, I just know that I can't. In fact, almost everybody can fast. There are literally millions of people around the world who regularly fast for religious purposes and before certain blood tests or routine procedures like a colonoscopy. It is standard to fast for up to 24 hours. People can fast if they simply try. Like anything else, fasting becomes easier the more often you do it. It doesn't take particular skill. It's not something to do. It's something to not do. You simply don't eat. It is subtraction, not addition. This makes it almost the exact opposite of every piece of advice on health ever given. Take vitamins, take drugs, have surgery. That's probably why fasting is so successful. To paraphrase Seinfeld, everybody wants a show about something. This is a show about nothing. Bariatric surgery certainly has many proven short-term benefits, although long-term benefits are more questionable. But it's not necessary. Imagine bariatric surgery without the post-operative complications, without the cost, without the need for expensive hospitals or surgical equipment, without the need for specially trained surgeons. All this is possible with what we might call medical bariatrics, fasting. Sidebar: fasting and cortisol. Cortisol is a hormone that's released during times of stress, whether physical or psychological. This activates the fight or flight response. It's a survival adaptation. However, cortisol is also one of the major drivers of obesity. In fact, synthetic cortisol, a medication called prednisone, consistently causes weight gain, particularly in the trunk. And because fasting may be considered a potential stressor, some are concerned that it may raise cortisol levels. But studies of intermittent fasting show that cortisol levels are generally unaffected. 2 weeks of intermittent fasting caused no increase in cortisol levels, and even a 72-hour fast failed to raise cortisol levels significantly. While levels may vary among individuals, on the whole, elevated cortisol levels are not a major concern during fasting. In my experience, the vast majority of people who fast do not have any problem with elevated cortisol levels. However, this does not mean that nobody will ever encounter this problem. On occasion, I have treated patients who felt that fasting negatively affected their cortisol levels. In these cases, it was necessary to change their dietary strategy. What to expect when fasting for weight loss? The amount of weight lost on a fasting regimen varies tremendously from person to person. The longer that you have struggled with obesity, the more difficult you'll find it to lose weight. Certain medications, such as insulin, may make it harder to lose weight. You must simply persist and be patient. You'll probably eventually experience a weight loss plateau as the weight lost during fasting begins to match the amount regained during eating. The only way not to plateau at all is to continually fast for weeks or months at a time. Otherwise, reaching an equilibrium is inevitable. Changing either your fasting regimen or diet or both may help. Some patients increase fasting from 24-hour periods to 36-hour periods or try a 48-hour fast. Some try eating only once a day every day. Others try a continuous fast for an entire week. Any of these can be effective. The key is simply to change the fasting protocol. Fasting has also been noted to trigger an early period of rapid weight loss, often averaging 1 to 2 pounds per day for the first few days. This isn't, unfortunately, due to loss of body fat. Fat loss during fasting averages approximately 0.5 pound a day. If you are losing 1 pound or more a day, the excess above 0.5 pound is water weight and will rapidly be regained upon eating. This is not abnormal or unusual. Don't be disappointed when the water weight returns or decide that fasting doesn't work. Chapter 6. Fasting for Type 2 Diabetes. The World Health Organization released its first global report on diabetes in 2016. It's clear from the report that diabetes is an unrelenting disaster. Since 1980, the number of people afflicted with diabetes has quadrupled. How did this ancient disease become the 21st century plague? Diabetes mellitus has been recognized for thousands of years. The ancient Egyptian medical text Eber's Papyrus, written around 1550 BC, was the first to describe this condition of passing too much urine. Around the same time, ancient Hindu writings discussed the disease of Madhumeha, loosely translated as honey urine. Patients were mysteriously wasting away, and no attempt to feed them was successful. Curiously, ants were attracted to their urine,